It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, filmmaker John Waters is coming to Wisconsin on Thursday. He joins us to talk about LGBT culture and life as an outsider artist.
First, Wisconsin lawmakers have proposed a bill that would create a statewide policy for which bathrooms transgender students can use at schools.
The bill would require transgender students to use bathrooms designated for the gender they were assigned at birth, not the gender that they currently identify with.
Supporters of that proposal say it would provide safety and privacy for all of Wisconsin's students. Opponents argue the new rules could isolate students who already deal with harassment and bullying at school.
Representative Jesse Kramer joined us last Friday to talk about that bill. Representative Kramer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, let's start off by finding out what you're looking to accomplish with this bill.
Sure. Well, this issue was not on my list of priorities when I ran for office last summer. I've got a lot of what I ran on accomplished already, but this just simply wasn't on my radar. I was aware of the topic following a 2013 story that broke regarding a six-year-old boy who was using the girls' bathroom in Oconomowoc, and the parents stated to the school district that he was transgender. And what the school district ultimately did was they started installing gender-neutral bathrooms. This past fall, however, this same situation occurred in the 59th Assembly District that I represent in a public school. And a senior who was a female identified as a male, and on numerous occasions she was frequenting the boys' bathroom while there were other classmates and students also utilizing this facility. The school district did not have a policy, as many school districts don't in Wisconsin right now. Some are starting to come up with policies, but there were lawyers lined up and ready to defend the student if the district made the wrong decision. And ultimately, the school district decided that the senior would be allowed to use a faculty restroom, and they settled on a policy very similar to what's being proposed by Senator Noss and me. So the actual bill itself basically states that whatever anatomy or chromosomes you were born with at birth, whatever your birth certificate says you're a male, well, then that's the bathroom and the locker room that you should be using. If you are a female, vice versa. And then for the transgender students, they have a way that they can now quietly talk to the school district and say, we want a reasonable alternative, and the school district would have to provide that. That could be exactly what Oconomowoc did. They started putting in separate neutral bathrooms. Or it could be providing something like QOSCM did, a faculty restroom. So that's basically the background behind the bill, why I did it, and what it would ultimately provide as a policy for the state.
So if there were no complaints from students, maybe, as you suggest, feeling uncomfortable that a student with different biological gender was in the same restroom, then that transgender student would no longer be allowed to use those common restrooms, but would be steered toward an alternative.
Correct. And I keep getting the argument from the other side that, well, we're just harassing, we're just discriminating, we're just bullying these transgender kids. And that really, I feel that this policy would provide less bullying and less harassment, because now it can be, these kids can go to the school and quietly say, I'd like an alternative. I don't feel comfortable using my birth gender restroom. And at the same time, I don't have to go walk into the opposite gender restroom and have, you know, maybe for a female identified as a male, have 10 guys standing at a urinal, and I'm walking in there, and they're going to be making fun of me and bullying me and harassing me, because everyone's going to know. Now no one has to know. You can go about it quietly and be accommodated for it.
In response to your bill, some in the transgender community have spoken up and have said that this is a bill that they feel could be damaging to mental health, and that it promotes exclusivity and it makes it so that someone cannot join the group that they feel that they're part of, and that could be damaging for them in a mental capacity. What do you say to that?
Well, it's amazing. All I ever hear from the other side is talk about themselves. This bill, I'm talking about all children. I'm talking about transgender children, and I'm talking about the other students. All I hear from them is, well, you know, this could be damaging to us. Well, what about those other kids? What about the 5-year-old, 6-year-old kid who's in the bathroom drops his trousers to the floor because he's using the urinal like he's been taught. And now you have fifth and sixth grade girls walking in there also. I mean, this is not something that that I think, you know, a lot of parents should be able to talk about anatomical differences on their own time without having to have a young son or daughter in school discovering this because there's mixed genders using every bathroom, every which bathroom. So I think there's an expectation of privacy and dignity and safety for every student involved, not just the transgender student, but also the other students.
Now, as you said, there are some districts in Wisconsin that have already begun to address this. Janesville and Madison, for instance, have come up with their own policies for dealing with this issue. Would this bill, if it were passed, would it override the current way that they've chosen to handle the situation?
Yes. So what this bill does is it actually provides a safety net for our districts in Wisconsin. Right now, there's a case going on in Virginia where a school district came up with a policy similar to what we're discussing here. And what the school district in my district used, providing a reasonable alternative for that transgender child. And what happened was the student is now suing the school district. The ACLU has jumped on board, and President Obama's Department of Justice has written a letter to that school district stating that they may be in violation of Title IX. Well, Title IX is a portion of the Federal Education Amendment of 1972, which discusses sexual discrimination in an educational setting. So what they're stating is this: they may be in violation and may be discriminatory. I want to be clear, though, that we have actual federal case law on our side that supports exactly what we are doing right now. No court has ever ruled against a school that enforced gender-specific bathrooms. In fact, in 2009 in Maricopa County, community college, they were sued because a student who was also an employee wanted to use a women's bathroom. Well, he sued under Title IX, Title VII, which is part of the Civil Rights Act, and the First and 14th Amendments, and the Ninth Circuit Court ruled in favor of the college for safety reasons. So this individual school districts who are coming up with individual policies in Wisconsin will no longer have to, if the federal government comes and decides they want to sue that district and take this district to task, that district isn't on their own anymore. We have a statewide policy now, and our Department of Justice is going to defend that statewide policy, and individual school districts will not be on the hook. It will be the state defending this policy.
We're talking with Representative Jesse Kramer from Kewaskum right now. He has proposed a bill that would create a statewide policy on transgender students using school bathrooms. And going back again to these individual schools, Representative Kramer, why do you think a statewide policy is better than allowing districts to handle the issue as they see fit, as they decide in their own school and community?
Sure, and that's something that I've actually been hearing from my conservative colleagues, the strong conservatives. Let's leave this up to local control. But once again, if you have a policy, say in my school district, where they said exactly what this Virginia school district did, and now you have the federal government coming in and saying, whoa, this is not right, you're in violation of Title IX, well, there's no way that school district is going to be able to defend that. And right now, with a statewide policy, we have the resources at the state level that we can actually go in and defend this and take care of this with the Department of Justice. And the Department of Justice has told me, even though we're blazing new territory here, there are a number of states that have looked into this. They are ready to defend this this statute.
And have you heard anything from your districts, from parents and students and teachers, about how they would feel about a bill like this?
It's actually been pretty quiet, and except for some on the left and some in the transgender community. It's been very quiet from the conservative side, and I feel that you know, this is a pretty taboo topic. People don't want to talk about it, and people don't want to be called out as bigots and haters and harassers. I've seen an awful lot of that on the social media already. It's been nonstop the last several days, just the anger out there. So I think people just don't want to be called out on it, and I was sent to Madison to do a job, and that job is to take on tough issues and talk about tough things that other people don't necessarily want to talk about. So I am representing the people of my district. They sent me here for a reason, and I'm not here to live and die by the polls or necessarily to bend my will to political correctness. I'm just going to do what's right for the people of my district.
Representative Kramer, thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay, thank you so much.
That was State Representative Jesse Kramer discussing a new proposal to create a statewide policy on bathroom use for transgender students in Wisconsin schools.
Acclaimed filmmaker John Waters is coming to Wisconsin this week as part of the Wisconsin Union Directorate's Distinguished Lecture Series. He'll be speaking in Madison on Thursday night at the Wisconsin Union Theater.
John Waters joins us now. He's a filmmaker and writer, and his latest book is called Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to coming.
So you're an out gay man who's lived through a lot of different LGBT milestones in American history. Do you kind of feel right now like the LGBT community is at a we've come a long way, baby kind of moment?
Oh, certainly. I remember when Obama lit up the White House in the gay rainbow flags when gay marriage passed. That was great. That made me very excited. But at the same way, I have no desire to get married, but I'm totally for it. I don't understand why anybody could be threatened. Everybody knows how hard it is to find anybody to fall in love with. So why would that threaten you? I mean, no matter what, if you're straight, gay, anything, it's hard to find anyone. So it's amazing to me that people would be against it. However, I don't want to do it, but there's a lot of heterosexual traditions. I don't want to do the electric slide either. There's lots of things I back away from.
Now, you've been talking about that a little about not wanting to get married, and you're wondering if gay couples who don't want to get married could be the next outsiders in that community. What makes you think about that?
Maybe they're going to be the only minority left with transgendered people that feel they made a rational, irrational decision and want another operation to go back with what they were first. You know, the gay community is quite complicated. Radical feminists have come out against transgendered women saying they had a penis in the beginning that gave them the power to get it cut off. It's very tricky these days.
Now, you've said that you think gay culture emulates straight culture maybe a little too much at times, and you want to give, especially gay people in entertainment, the chance to be bad guys sometimes. What do you mean by that?
Well, the people in entertainment have it easy. What gay person really in the arts is discriminated against? I think straight people should have marches in rich kids' schools. They're the ones that are discriminated against. And I joke that gay acceptance is so big now that we have enough. You know, I know it's coming out day here, and I'm for that. That's why the Republicans gave up on fighting gay marriage, because their own families were gay, and they realized it was a losing battle. But at the same time, sometimes I think we have enough. I'm for coming in, too. Sometimes I think you should audition to be gay.
When you say we have enough, what are you referring to? Enough acceptance?
Well, numbers-wise, I think we have to get quality now. Quantity and quality are two different things. No, I'm basically kidding. It's just sometimes it's kind of funny that the gay acceptance has, but it's usually in wealthy communities. It's a weirdly a class issue acceptance now, which is something that I find troubling.
Now, the transgender movement, has got a lot of momentum going right now in terms of public awareness, in part thanks to Caitlyn Jenner. How do you see that playing out over the next couple years?
Well, I think it's great. I think transgendered, you know, I had a transgendered woman in Pink Flamingos. To me, it's a little not that new. I'm much more fascinated in a way with transgendered men because I think it feels newer. And can we not ever make fun, though? Caitlyn Jenner is a Republican who was against gay marriage, a Kardashian, and a reality star. We can't make fun of that? I don't know. I feel like my assistant, when she was still Bruce and was doing the interview with Diane Sawyer and was in that car accident, said, women drivers. You know, I thought that was funny.
We're talking with John Waters right now, filmmaker and writer. His latest book is called Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. He's going to be speaking in Madison on Thursday night at the Wisconsin Union Theater. And John, your muse, Divine, a legal name there was Glenn Milstead, was a childhood friend and a drag queen that was featured in a lot of your movies. What do you think Divine would make of where LGB culture is today from shows like RuPaul's Drag Race or just how mainstream gay culture has become?
Well, I think Divine was not transgendered in any way. I always said he didn't want to pass as a woman. He wanted to pass as a monster. He was created to scare hippies. Divine never walked around in drag in real life. He had no desire to be a woman. He wore expensive men's suits at the end of his career. But he would be for the transgendered movement. He would be for gay marriage. He would be for everything. But Divine, to be honest, was not that political. But I think his career was political. What drag queen today everybody on RuPaul, and I did the RuPaul show this year, isn't cutting edge. You know, when I was young, drag queens wanted to be Bess Meyerson and their mother and beauty queens. Today, they all carry chainsaws and have names like Aretha Franklin. I think Divine had something to do with it. That's a great drag name, isn't it?
It is. Well, let's talk a little bit about your career. Now, you've been on the outskirts by choice, the outskirts of culture, most of your entire artistic life. Some circles you were known as the Prince of Puke. Why do you feel more comfortable there on the fringes?
I don't. I'm much more comfortable being an insider now because everybody else wants to be an outsider. I just came back from London where I had a 50-year tribute at the British Film Institute. I had a 50-year tribute last year at Lincoln Center. I can't get to be more of an insider in a weird way, which is the final irony of my life.
But your work is still, I mean, it's been recognized in mainstream culture and celebrated and lots of people quote it, so it's definitely got cultural cachet, but it's still not, you know, it's not going to be a Tom Hanks goes to the moon sort of movie. It's still on the outside.
Well, Hairspray sort of became as close as I could get to a giant hit. It's still, who would have ever thought that the musical would be playing in every high school in America? So it was the Trojan horse I thought of that snuck in culture.
So what does that mean to you then, being someone who started on the outside and kind of went mainstream?
It's hilarious. It's good. I don't have anything to complain about. I've had a wonderful career. My dreams came true years ago. This is all gravy and fun, and I'm excited to be alive for it.
So what is next for you then? You sound like you've hit some of these artistic milestones, and now you're just speaking your mind. What do you want to do next? What excites you?
Well, I have either a television show I can't talk about or a book I'm going to write next. My last two books were bestsellers and went over well, so my book tour never ends. You know, I have a spoken word show. I have a Christmas show I'm doing this year in 17 cities in 20 days in America. So I'm always on the road. I live on the road. I'm a carny.
Well, you mentioned Hairspray, and that was, of course, you said turned into a musical, which became super popular. What was that transition like from to music, to words, to singing?
Well, finally, my parents could come to one of my openings and say, we enjoyed it and their nose didn't grow. You know, from all the other years, my father, when he saw my last movie, said, it was funny, but I hope I never see it again. which was a great quote, I think. It was great. It was. I learned so much about Broadway musicals from being involved in that from the very beginning, and the team I worked with were so lucky. They did an absolutely amazing job of turning my movie, which was basically a dance movie, it was not a musical, into a musical that is celebrated all over the world. So it was a wonderful experience.
Let's talk about your book, Carsick. This is about you hitchhiking and taking a road trip across the United States. Why did you want to do that? I know you've got some carny in your blood, but why did you decide to do that?
I needed an adventure. I needed, my life was getting a little too safe, a little too predictable, a little too scheduled. I'm scheduled for the next 2 years already, so I thought, what would happen if I gave that up? And most people my age hitchhiked when they were young, and most young people have never hitchhiked, but they wanted to now. So I'm encouraging it. It's green. You might meet some people. It's a new way to travel. So I wanted an adventure, and I got one.
Well, what do you remember most about that trip? You met a lot of people along the way, but when you think back on it, what really sticks out is one or two of the iconic moments.
What sticks out is the worst part, standing there for 10 hours waiting for a ride. That is what stands out, something that I never imagined when I thought up the worst that could happen, which is, of course, diarrhea and getting murdered. And the best that could happen, which is sex and adventure and meeting exciting new people. But in real life, none of those things happen. But the general people that picked me up could not have been lovelier. You know, people that pick up hitchhikers are good people.
Now, you said you had to stand there for 10 hours waiting for a ride. Does that mean you had to sort of refine your sticking out the thumb technique there? Did you need to do anything differently?
No, I just contemplated drinking my own urine. Because I was standing there for so long in the heat without water that I actually whined to my assistant on the phone that exact statement.
I'm glad you explained that.
I'm sure resisted the urge to chuckle.
Well, you did. Like you said, you met some really interesting people, and among them, I gather, was a sandy-haired Republican there, not the person you expected maybe to bond with, but what was that like?
Oh, it's great. I'm going to be in his wedding next year, too, so we're still friends. I'm still in contact with many of the people that picked me up hitchhiking. The Kansas couple came to my book signing in Baltimore. I've had dinner with Here We Go Magic, the rock group, the Corvette Kid, as he called in the book. I'm going to be in his wedding. So I bonded and became lasting friends with the people that picked me up hitchhiking.
Well, so you're coming to Madison on Thursday. First, what are you going to do here, and what are you going to talk about?
Well, I have a show called This Filthy World that is constantly updated, so I talk about politics, crime, fashion. Basically, it's a self-help talk for people that are insane and are happy with being insane but want to live a life and get through life without having to change and still be happy. So I think I'm looking forward. I meet my people all over the world, and they're a special group.
So people who are insane. And what advice do you give people? I think a lot of us feel like there is a part of us that's a little different. We don't want to change. What advice do you have?
Well, that advice, exaggerate that, what you used to be frightened of, and turn it into a style, and you'll win. But at the same time, if you see some behavior coming that you repeat and it brings you unhappiness every time, it's time to change it. And you've got to figure out if it's worth it. And that's the complicated thing. And once you reach a certain age, you can't really blame your parents after you're 30. Really, stop whining. Get on with it.
John, so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
As filmmaker and writer John Waters, his latest book is Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. He's going to be speaking in Madison on Thursday night at the Wisconsin Union Theater.
A new bill by two Republican lawmakers would allow concealed weapons in public university and college buildings. It would revoke an exception made to Wisconsin's current concealed carry law, allowing institutions of higher learning to enact bans inside of campus buildings. Concealed carry is already allowed outside on campus property.
The proposal comes 2 weeks after a gunman killed 9 people at an Oregon community college. Supporters say the law will allow students to defend themselves from crime or in a mass shooting situation. Critics say more guns could increase violence in a place full of young people and alcohol.
Here with us now to talk about the proposal is Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA and author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Adam, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Wisconsin is considering this. I know this has been a debate in other states. How common are laws that allow concealed weapons on university campuses?
Well, 7 states have laws that allow people to carry concealed guns on campus, although the details can vary on who can carry and where they can carry. About 20 states completely ban the carrying of concealed weapons on a college campus, including my home state of California, which just adopted a new law just this past week. And about 22 states leave the decision up to individual colleges. And most colleges and universities prohibit guns on campus.
As I understand it, Utah, as of a few years ago, was the only state that allowed it. It's taken off. There's been a movement in this direction around the country. Why did this idea take off?
Well, this has taken off because there's many people who favor strong gun rights who believe that really guns should be everywhere, that if you don't have guns in a place, then it's a so-called gun-free zone, and it's an actual invitation to mass shooters to come to that place because you know you can find a lot of unarmed victims who won't be able to shoot back.
Now, there's strong arguments on both sides. You've written in the past that they're both wrong to some extent. So let's take each in turn. First off, this argument that having guns on campus will help prevent things like mass shootings. What do we know about that?
Well, it doesn't appear to be the case that having guns on campus will lead to any significant reduction in mass shootings. You know, part of the issue is that most of the people on a college campus wouldn't be allowed to carry a concealed gun anyway. For instance, your state, Wisconsin, allows concealed carry of firearms, but you have to be 21 years or older to get a concealed carry license. That eliminates virtually half or more of the undergraduates at any given time at the university who just wouldn't be allowed to carry a gun no matter what. Moreover, having more people armed in a situation, while it is true that in some circumstances that might help put an end to a mass shooting quicker, you have to factor in the possibility of having another shooter there, more collateral damage, and also the possibility of gun accidents or gun thefts that lead to more criminal activity as well.
And one of the objections that's often raised to the idea is that, hey, you've got people maybe young, maybe impulsive, alcohol, not uncommon on college campuses, in Wisconsin maybe in particular. So this is going to create a hazard. We're going to see more accidental or intentional shootings outside of the mass shootings you already have. How does that pan out?
Well, that turns out to be an argument that we often hear as well. again, it's hard to know exactly what the data would show. We don't really have much data on this, and as a result of the fact that most states either ban people from having concealed guns on campus, or the universities within that state have their own policies banning such guns, we just don't really know what the data would show. But we do know that college campuses are among the safest places for young people to be, even though they don't have access to guns today.
Talking to Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA, author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, looking at proposals in the Wisconsin legislature to allow the carry of concealed weapons on college and university campuses in buildings in particular. Adam, you in that piece you wrote some years back made the case that this isn't really necessarily about safety one way or the other. It's about our attitude toward guns. Can you expand on that?
Well, yeah, I think what's really going on for many gun advocates is they want to see guns everywhere. They want to see guns normalized. And one of the best ways to normalize people to the presence of guns is to do it when people are young. That's when they really gain their values and their understanding of the world. And I think for many gun control advocates as well, that's part of the rationale. They want to keep guns off campus precisely for that reason. They don't want people to become habituated to the commonplace possession of guns everywhere. And so part of this is a culture war, and as most culture wars, the battle lines are drawn around the youth.
Now, yesterday, University of Wisconsin professors were responding to the bill on Twitter and elsewhere. A professor named Don Moynihan wrote, quote, "As a faculty member who has lived through budget cuts, attacks on tenure, requiring or allowing guns in my classroom would be a last straw." So as a professor yourself, is this often how university faculty feels about these laws? They don't want guns in their classroom and their office hours?
I think it's fair to say that most faculty do not want guns on the classroom in classrooms because, in part, they've had experiences with students who are young and who, perhaps through immaturity or perhaps through the extreme stress of being young and not having a really well-developed prefrontal cortex that controls impulse and long-term consequential decision-making, they're afraid that students will act out, become angry, and take revenge upon a professor. I think this is generally unlikely. And the truth of the matter is, those people can have guns on campus today. Now, the law may say, or the university policy may say, you can't have a gun on campus. But I don't know about you, I've never been on a college campus where I've had my bag searched. I've never been on a college campus that really had rules in place, like, say, an airport, to really prevent people from carrying guns. And given the fact that everyone's carrying a backpack in which a handgun would easily fit, not sure that the rules that say no guns on campus are really all that effective in keeping guns off campus.
I wanted to follow up on the idea of gun-free zones. So we hear arguments, whether we're talking about campuses, schools, elementary schools for that matter, the idea that gun-free zone, as you mentioned, people see that as maybe being a target. Somebody who wants to do a mass shooting, that's where they're going to start. Have we seen, and I know you may not have perused the journals of all mass shooters, but have we seen evidence that that is a consideration for mass shooters?
I don't think there's been any social scientific evidence that has shown that to be the case, that mass shooters target places in which other people won't have guns. Indeed, one of the things, and one reason to suspect that's not the case, is that one of the things we know about most mass shooters is that they expect to die in the incident. And many mass shooters, of course, do die in the incident. Either they turn the gun on themselves, or they're shot by a police officer, and every once in a while shot by a bystander who has a firearm. So these are usually moments of suicide where people are taking a lot of people down with them. It's not clear to me that given the idea that one wants to go down with them, one would be so prevented from going to a place where other people might have guns. And, of course, we do know of plenty of mass shootings that happen in places that are not gun-free zones. Remember, Gabrielle Giffords was shot in Arizona out in the public, you know, in a big parking lot. You know, in Arizona, you don't even need a permit to carry a concealed weapon.
You mentioned that an argument like this over guns on campuses is as much a culture war issue as it is about evidence. Are people pretty much impervious to actual evidence about what the presence or absence of guns does once they've made up their mind which side they're on?
Well, I do think that the two sides in America's gun debate really have profoundly different worldviews, and as a result of those worldviews, really couldn't agree on the kinds of evidence that they'd find persuasive in any case. For many gun enthusiasts, they want more guns because they think the best way to reduce gun violence is for more people to be armed, and that creates disincentives for people to actually commit crimes with guns. For many gun control advocates, they see the world and causation exactly the opposite. They say, look, if we want to reduce firearms deaths, we need to reduce access to firearms. And because they both have very different understandings of the causes and consequences of gun violence, it's incredibly difficult for them to come to agreement as to what kind of evidence would be persuasive in the gun debate.
I was just reading a piece, I think it's from the AP this morning, saying there isn't as much research as you think there might be. The CDC is restricted by law passed by Congress on how much data collection they can do, how much research they can do on gun violence as a public health issue. Are there a lot of unanswered questions that we just don't have access to the answers on?
They're almost all unanswered questions. It's really quite remarkable, given the fact that gun violence takes the lives of about 30,000 Americans every year. That includes both homicides and the majority of gun deaths, which are suicides. Every other major public health problem that leads to the deaths of thousands of people is the subject of extensive research, much of it financed by the federal government, and like you say, the CDC or the National Institutes of Health. And yet we have very, very little research that goes into gun violence prevention, in part because the NRA has been very successful at shutting off the spigot of federal research dollars that would go to gun violence prevention research. So we really just don't know what the best ways to control guns, because we just don't have the data.
We're talking to Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA and author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Yesterday, two state Republican lawmakers unveiled a bill that would allow concealed weapons inside public university and college buildings.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think concealed carry should be allowed in college campus buildings in Wisconsin? Why or why not? And do you study or do you work on a public campus? Does your child or spouse? Let us know what you think and how it might affect you and your family. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA and the author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Yesterday, two state Republican lawmakers unveiled a bill that would allow concealed weapons inside public university buildings in Wisconsin.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should concealed carry be allowed in campus buildings? Why? Why not? Could this help prevent mass shootings or would it create new dangers? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. A comment from Josh on Facebook who says laws that make people unholster, unload, lock up before they leave their car are unsafe, create unnecessary transitions. They also leave guns in a place easier to be stolen than could end up in the hands of criminals where no one wants them. So, Adam, that's been one argument against having these no gun zones is that, hey, if it's legal for people to concealed carry, this is going to create weird situations for them where they would have to leave their gun maybe unattended, maybe in a vehicle.
Well, that is definitely a possibility. If someone has a right to carry a concealed gun, they can drive their car and have the gun in the car. When they get to a college campus, they won't be able to bring their guns either onto campus or perhaps they'll be able to leave them, depending on the state rules, in a parking lot. And that does create an issue with some gun owners would have to unholster their gun and create a moment where they might be vulnerable. However, that seems like a very unlikely situation. We don't have any data to show that people are often attacked at the moment that they're unholstering their gun. In fact, you might imagine that people would be less likely to attack them when they have their gun unholstered. And it is certainly the case, though, that if they leave their gun in their car, it could be subject to theft. You know, people will happily break into a car to steal your iPod. A firearm can be sold on the black market for much more than the iPod, and as a result, they may be a tempting target for someone who wanted someone who wanted to steal one.
Go to our callers now. Dave is on the line in Eau Claire. Dave, hi.
Hi. That'd be, as you were talking about this about 10 minutes ago, I was thinking about, is there really a ban on research into the data around gun safety? Can you give some details about what that ban looks like? What was the legislation and the reasoning behind it? And then, secondarily, what would it take to fund that outside heroin? How much money would it take to get good data?
Dave, thanks for the call. Adam?
It's a great question, and I don't want to be heard to suggest that there's a ban on doing gun violence prevention research. What there is a ban on the Center for Disease Control, which is one of the major financers of research into public health programs into America, on doing studies that lead to gun control proposals and the advancement of gun violence prevention efforts. And that law was put in place by the NRA and its allies in Congress, specifically because they were afraid that the government agencies were going to only finance studies that tended to show that gun control works. And for the NRA and its allies in Congress, they don't believe that gun control works and don't want the government to be supporting research that goes to support something that will that is against their beliefs and might be used to limit Second Amendment rights. What will it take to change that law? I think you really need to change Congress, and nothing like that is happening. I will say that the president has taken some executive actions to free up money as much as he can in accordance with the law for gun violence prevention research. So a little bit more money is flowing in that direction. But still, it's a very underfinanced area of research.
Dave, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Kristen in Madison. Kristen, hi.
Hi, how are you? I've worked for the UW system since 1999 in a variety of different roles, sometimes teaching, sometimes researching, and I've been the person that stood in front of classrooms of 150 students. And I can tell you, I love my students, but the thought of my students carrying arms in a classroom is absolutely frightening. I have yet to see evidence that more guns makes us more safe as a society. We have one gun for every man, woman, and child in this nation, and the number of shootings we've had have just exploded over the recent years. And I just urge people to call and let legislators know that this is not a good move for anyone at the university system. We are scared.
Kristen, thanks a lot for sharing your perspective. I wanted to key in on one point she mentioned there, Adam, the idea that the number of shootings has exploded or gone up in recent years. What are the statistics like there? There are 30-some thousand, you said, a year, but is there a trend?
Well, in fact, while I certainly understand the frustrations of the caller, the data show the opposite, which is that we are at 40-year lows in terms of gun violence in America today. We are seeing a spike in mass shootings, it appears, although the numbers are somewhat in doubt. They certainly are getting a lot more press and media attention and have caused much more public controversy than they have in the past. But the overall rates of gun violence and gun crime and gun homicides is remarkably down, less than half of what it was in 1990, for instance. So one of the interesting things that's happening right now, at least from my perspective as an academic, is that we see a real reinvigoration of the gun debate, a real sense of Americans that we have to do something soon about this gun violence problem, at the same time while our violent crime rates are at historic lows. It's really an interesting phenomenon.
But to Kristen's main point that as somebody standing up in front of a classroom full of young students, not feeling comfortable, feeling maybe frightened of the notion of a lot of them maybe carrying firearms, this is a perception that's shared in other institutions around the country.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think many of us are attracted to academia because we believe in the world of ideas, and that we believe that universities are a place where we can have conversations about even the most difficult, trying, and emotional issues as part of an effort to gain more education and insight into the world's problems and values. The idea that students will be armed scares many of us who have to be in the classroom. Look, I'm a law professor. Law professors are famous for cold calling on their students, for very, very aggressive questioning, really pushing students sometimes to the brink. I hate to think that there might be a student out there who has a firearm and who would react negatively. But again, I want to emphasize, there is nothing in our current university rules. Well, there are things in the university policies that stop guns on campus, but nothing in our actual practices that stop some crazed student who really wants to kill a professor from bringing a gun on campus.
Kristen, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234, talking about a proposal in Wisconsin's legislature to allow concealed carry on campuses in university and college buildings. Adam Winkler is with us, professor of law at UCLA. Back to our callers with Elizabeth in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
I'm no longer a university student. I went to UW-Eau Claire, though, and just the thought of having another student in my classes who would be carrying a weapon that could kill any one of us at any given moment, I think it's sick. I think it's pretty sick that anyone would even want to carry a gun, let alone in a big group of people. What about, like, our rights, my right to be in a safe classroom where there aren't weapons? My question.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. Adam, definitely a culture difference here. A lot of people like Elizabeth, astounded at the notion. A lot of people who are gun owners thinking this is a perfectly natural thing. How do we get these sides talking to each other, not past each other?
Well, that is really the trick for America's gun debate, isn't it? I mean, we really are talking past each other. I can imagine someone, a caller, and saying almost the exact same thing, but with the conclusion that one should be able to have a gun in a college campus. They would point to all these shootings, like the recent shooting at the Oregon Community College, and say, hey, you know what? I would be safer if there was someone in that classroom who could fight back and who could limit the damage from a mass shooter. Or maybe just the fact that other people have guns in that classroom means the mass shooter is going to go to a different place. Again, I don't know that the data would support those arguments, but that's the worldview that the other side from this caller, that's the worldview that they have, and I think it's a reason why we're talking past each other rather than talking to each other.
Adam, we're talking about this legislation in Wisconsin. We've talked about other states that have allowed concealed carry in classrooms at universities and colleges. Has this ever been tried at the federal level, something to preempt and say, hey, all states, all universities around the country, no more gun-free zones?
Well, there is an effort from the Republican caucus in the House to push for national reciprocity of concealed carry. That would basically mean that if you have the right to carry a concealed gun in one place, in one state, you can carry that concealed gun in all states. It wouldn't go so far as to completely eliminate gun-free zones, but there are efforts underfoot, and I think that if we were to see a Republican president in 2016 and a Republican House and perhaps even a Republican Senate, I think you would see legislation to make concealed carry of firearms through national legislation a statutory right, a right guaranteed to you by federal law.
As we move into the future, do you think this debate, this political debate over guns on university campuses and university buildings is going to be coming up in more and more states?
You know, I do think it's going to be coming up in more and more states. Wisconsin is not at the cutting edge here in light of the fact that just a few years ago there was only one state that allowed it, and now there's seven. This is part of an effort by gun rights advocates to push for broader concealed carry rights. It's something that they've been trying to do for about 30 odd years and have been very successful in providing greater ability for people to carry concealed guns in public. Colleges and universities are just the next area where they want to free up people to carry guns.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA. He's the author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Yesterday, two state Republican lawmakers unveiled a bill that would allow concealed weapons inside public university buildings. And you can keep sharing your thoughts on the topic over at the Central Time Facebook page.